For typhoid or cholera? Those are inoculations administered by the county-level health department for travelers overseas, and even then they have to be special-ordered. I bet there's not one person in 1,000 in this valley protected against cholera, unless they've traveled to Africa or southern Asia, and damn few against typhoid. Thank God our elevation's high enough, our climate cool enough, that I'm not worrying about mosquito-borne diseases like malaria, West Nile, and others. And don't even get me started on how we better start looking out for parasitic worms, lice. His voice trailed off. We'll see infections running rampant that won't kill, but will weaken, leaving the victim open for the next round. Kate, most guys don't even think of it, but do you have a good supply of what we euphemistically call feminine hygiene products? She blushed slightly.
For this month?
Right there, gentlemen. Though I bet a lot of women are thinking about it now or finding out real quick. They're back to great-grandma's days, and that, combined with no bathing, poor diet, we'll see a soaring infection rate. And that's just one of a dozen situations we never thought about before last week. Johnny steps on a rusty nail. Get a tetanus shot. We might have 100 of those left in the whole community. We might be staring at lockjaw come fall. Shall I go on? No one spoke. John looked into his old friend's eyes and could see that this doctor, more than perhaps anyone else in the room, was haunted by just how medieval this nightmare might get. As a historian, John knew the horror. For every person who died in the westward migration prior to the Civil War from Native Americans attacking, the stuff of American legends, thousands, maybe tens of thousands, died from water holes polluted by cholera and typhoid. But that doesn't make for a good movie. One thing we've neglected I want taken care of right now, Keller said, and I could kick myself for not thinking of it sooner. Get the veterinarians organized. Vets? Carl asked. Hell yes. They have anesthesia and antibiotics and, frankly, in a pinch, can do emergency surgery as well. Inside a dog isn't all that different from a human. Same with dentists, podiatrists as well. Get the meds they still have, move them to the clinic we've agreed to set up in Swannanoa, and guard it 24 hours a day. Charlie noted it down. Back to the refugees. What do we do? Charlie asked. Seal it off, Carl said. We continue to seal it off, Tom replied, and I tell you there'll be 50,000 piled up on that road by the end of the week, and sooner or later they'll storm us. Casualties be damned.
A safety valve, then, Kate interjected.
How's that? Charlie asked.
We got a pressure cooker ready to blow on the interstate at the gap. Either we have it blow in our faces, or we create a safety valve.
Like I said, how? Charlie said, a touch of exasperation in his voice.
Let people through.
God damn, Carl snapped. I thought this alliance was so we can guard each other's backs, and now you're talking about letting them in? If so, we pull out of the deal. You are already in the deal, Charlie said coldly. And once in, you can't leave. Jesus, you're starting to sound like a damn Yankee, and I'm a rebel. If we want to secede out of this union, we'll do so. Kate has it right, John said. Oh, great, the professor speaks, Carl replied, voice filled with sarcasm. Damn you, listen to some reasoning, John shouted. The outburst made him feel lightheaded, his hand throbbing. It caught Carl off guard, though. She's right. We let people through 100 at a time with the understanding that they don't stop until past the barrier on the far side of exit 59. Then they can keep on going. They check their weapons in with us, just like when cowboys rode into town and the sheriff met them. We give the weapons back once they're on the far side of our territory. No food give-outs. But for decency's sake, at least set up a watering spot, say by exit 64. There should be enough water pressure to run a temporary pipe up there. A privy as well, with lots of lime thrown in and safe drainage. Charlie nodded. We hold them back, like Tom said, and the pressure will build until they just overrun us. What about the threat of disease that Doc Keller was talking about? Tom asked.
I think when comparing one threat to another, what Kate and John are saying is the lesser of two evils. If someone is visibly sick, we don't let them through. Quarantine, like the old days. Everyone else, they can walk on through, but no stopping. Armed guards keep their distance while escorting them.
We have hazmat suits, Charlie announced.
What?
20 of them, stockpiled in the storage area of this building. They were issued out by Homeland Security a couple of years back. Never thought we'd be using them like this, but would that serve?
Damn good,
Kelly replied.
Anyone interacting at the barricades with those on the other side wears a hazmat.
Good psychological impact as well, John interjected. Conveys authority, and frankly, though I hate to say it, those on the other side will feel inferior, and thus more compliant about being marched through without stopping.
He was inwardly angry for even mentioning that. Uniforms, and the white hazmat suits were like uniforms, had always been one of the means throughout history to control crowds, including those being herded to death camps.
Water only, like I said. Sharp watch that no one relieves themselves other than at the designated privy. Armed guards in hazmats escorting them. They're allowed through, and that's it.
What about Asheville?
Kate said.
They might block the road as well.
There's no defensive barricade there yet, Carl said. They are assuming the flow is all towards us. We might get away with it for a few days before they organize. If they do, we try some logic on them to just let these people keep moving. Or, as the professor there said, we mention the water supply and make them an offer they can't refuse.
John looked around the room, and there was no dissent.
Good plan, Charlie finally said. That's what we'll do.
One change on it, though. Some should be allowed in to stay, Kate replied.
How's that? Keller asked.
There's hundreds of people from right here who got stuck on the day everything went down, driving back home, driving to meetings, flying in or out of Charlotte. They have every right to be here, and we must let them in. Nearly everyone from Asheville who got stuck there is back, but we have people, several hundred, still missing. When they show up, we got to let them in, along with those who own property here and are trying to get to it as a safe haven. They've lived with us for years. We owe them that chance if they make it here.
What about the disease, though? Charlie asked.
Well, like the doc said, quarantine, John replied. It's the way things were done 100 years ago with ships coming into New York.
A doctor inspected the passengers. If he was suspicious, they were put in an isolation ward.
Again, a film image came to John.
Remember Godfather 2? When the Don came to America as a little boy and was put in isolation because they thought he might be sick? We did it all the time then, and it worked.
Yeah, and look what we got with that guy, the Mafia, Carl replied.
John realized he had pulled the wrong analogy, but pressed on.
The practices of 100 years ago did work, and we have to step back to them. If a ship came from a port where they knew there was some outbreak of a contagious disease, the ship itself was anchored in the outer harbor until it was deemed safe to pass.
We can do the same, John said, looking hopefully at Keller.
Keller hesitated, then nodded in agreement.
Doc, what about the nursing home? John asked, and Keller shook his head.
That place is crawling with every infection known to man. I'd suggest one of the larger buildings at the Baptist Church Conference Center, right up near the gap. It's right off the road.
He looked around, and everyone finally nodded.
Look, I know I won't be popular with some of you bringing this up, Carl said, but the outsiders, those that wandered in here the first few days before we sealed off, that boosted our numbers by maybe 2,000 or more. Do we let them stay?
No one spoke in reply, but Kate was shaking her head.
We've settled that here, Charlie said, and John looked over at him, his thoughts instantly going to Michaela.
Why? Carl asked. I think we should have talked about this before our deal was made.
"What are you suggesting, Carl?" Charlie snapped. "They've been here 8 to 10 days now. Many have integrated in, found a friend or a job to do. What are we going to do, march around town and round them up at gunpoint? It would be one hell of a sight, and frankly tear us apart."
"We were once all Americans," Kate said quietly.
"Precisely," John now interjected. "Those that are here stay. We've already made that agreement." He looked around at the others. In spite of his speech in the park, he wondered now if views were changing because a food shortage was now clearly evident.
"No different than keeping out those on the other side," Carl replied.
"Maybe not, God save us," John replied. "I don't have an answer for that. But those that are in, stay." He looked to Charlie for support. "We change that view now, and I am off this council. It contradicts what I said at the park, and neither you nor anyone else objected then."
"What about what we did get off the road?" Kate said. "We are forgetting about that. We got 6 trucks loaded with foodstuffs, enough rations to feed all of them for a couple of weeks. Consider that as their payment."
John nodded to her, an adroit move on her part. "They stay," Charlie finally said, and Carl nodded his head. "One other thing," John interjected. "Those passing through, anyone special, we should allow them to stay if they wish."
"Like who?"
Keller asked. "Anyone that can help us survive now, or rebuild. Such as?" "Military men, police officers, for example." He knew he'd get immediate nods from Tom and Carl on that. The fraternal order definitely looked out for its own, and John realized he was doing the same when it came to the military. "But others, farmers, they have skills we need, can help with the cattle, hogs, and what crops are planted. All that fancy machinery is dead, and a lot of farming is reverted to back-breaking labor. I think we should grab any electrician we can find, power company guys, people like that, doctors, nurses as well. If they want to stay, we interview them. If they check out okay, they can join us." There was a moment of silence again.
"Agreed," Charlie replied.
"That means their families as well," Kate said. "I wouldn't give 2 cents for a man or woman who would grab the chance to stay and walk away from their family."
"No argument there," Charlie finally replied. "John, could you draw up a list of recommended skills you think we should have?" John nodded. "Frankly, I'd kill for someone who could build a steam engine." There was a round of chuckles at that. "No, people, I'm dead serious. A steam engine would be worth its weight in gold. Do any of you know how to make one, let alone repair an old one rotting behind a barn and then keep it running?" Everyone was silent. The thought started him rolling. Get a steam engine and you have power where you want it. To pump, dig, cut, hell, even mount it on the rail tracks and move things. I'd like to find some old guy who repaired phone lines 40 years ago and could retrofit us. Prowl through the antique stores on Cherry Street, and you'll find old crank phones that still might work if we could find someone who understood how to hook them up. It'd link the 2 ends of our community." Several were now nodding. "The guys I know in my Civil War roundtable, Revolutionary War reenactors, many of them know skills that are lost to the rest of us. I want people like that. I'd trade 100 computer tech heads right now for 1 guy who understood steam engines. I'd trade 100 lawyers for someone who could show us how to make gunpowder from what we can find here in this valley, or which roots we can dig right now and safely eat. An old chemist who could make ether or chloroform. Doc, we're going to need a lot of that in the months to come, and I'm willing to bet we're short already. An old dentist who could get an old-fashioned foot-powered drill running. You folks think about that yet, next time you get a toothache? Care to have the tooth yanked instead and no painkiller while we're at it? Remember the old movies? The ones about a gang of kids and one of them usually had a bandage wrapped around his head to keep his jaw shut because he had an abscessed tooth? If we saw that 2 weeks ago, the parents would have been arrested for child abuse. But I tell you, we'll be seeing that again, and real soon." He suddenly realized he was rambling. The room silent, suddenly far too hot. "Sorry."
No one spoke, and he wasn't sure if it was because they were embarrassed by his rambling monologue, or because he had indeed hit home with what they faced.
"I think we have it all for now," Charlie said. "Let's get to work. Meeting same time tomorrow."
The group stood up, and John felt a stab of pain. Keller was bent over the table, holding John's right hand down and taking off the bandage. The group looked over at them, and he could see concern in Kate's eyes.
"John, I think you better go home. You're running a fever. I'll see if I can dig something up for it and come by later," Keller said.
"I told you, that nurse, the tall, good-looking one, Michaela's her name. She's giving me Cipro."
"Well, it should have kicked in by now. I don't like this."
And Keller sniffed the bandage again, his nose wrinkling. John looked down at his hand. It was swollen, red-streaked, the exposed wound red, the edge of the flesh where it had been stitched together, puckered. He was suddenly worried. God damn, an infected hand now? He had images of Civil War-era surgery.
"What the hell is it, Doc?"
Kate asked, coming closer.
"Maybe staph, but I don't have the lab to test for it. Crops up in hospitals, nursing homes, resistant stuff. Go home. Go to bed. I'll be by later today or this evening."
"I said I was going up to the college to get some volunteers for the elementary school. Last thing I want is you walking around at the college or in the elementary school with that hand. If you got a staph infection, you're a spreader now. So just go home."
John nodded and stood up, feeling weak. He headed to the door, Keller walking alongside him. Starting the car up, John headed for home, and as he pulled into the driveway, he knew. Jen was outside, sitting on the stone wall of the walkway leading to the door. Elizabeth was on one side of her, Jennifer on the other. As he got out of the car, the dogs came up, but a sharp command warned them to back off.
"It's Tyler, isn't it?" John said.
Jen forced a smile and nodded. Jennifer started to sob, and he put his good arm around her, his little girl burying her head in his chest.
"Pop, pop,"
was all she could get out. Jen put a hand on her granddaughter's shoulder.
"Pop, pop is in heaven now, dear. But it's okay to cry."
Elizabeth leaned against John's shoulder, forcing back a sob, but then looked up at him.
"Dad, you're burning up."
"I'm okay," he said.
He looked at Jen.
"Let's go in,"
she said. He followed her into the house, which was all so silent, and into what had been Jennifer's room. Tyler's features were already going to a grayish yellow. John remembered the first time they had met, Tyler coldly looking at this Yankee, worse yet from New Jersey, who obviously had but one intent only, and that was to seduce his only daughter and take her away. John smiled.
"Oh, I understand that now, Pop," he thought.
And then so many other memories of the gradual thaw. The first time they'd gone out shooting together while the girls went to the mall to go shopping. Tyler, fascinated by the old Colt Dragoon pistol John had brought along, roaring with laughter over the encounter with the local rednecks that had happened but weeks before. That had been an icebreaker. Father and potential son-in-law shooting, talking guns, then sitting on the patio and having a cold beer. And then the grudging acceptance that had turned to friendship, and at last had turned to the love a father would have for a son who then gave him two beautiful granddaughters, granddaughters who allowed him once again to relive the joy of raising a child. He was gone now. War or not, he would have died. But he had indeed died far sooner as a result of the war. In the cold figures of triage, he was an old man, someone whom villages, towns, and cities all across America this day, but 10 days after an attack, were being forced to write off. For an old man in the advanced stages of cancer, there would be no medicine. That had to be rationed now to someone who stood a chance, or who, in a colder sense, could be of use. If the old man were not dying at home, his would be a body whose departure would free a bed in a hospital flooded with the sick and injured. In a starving community, his would be one less mouth to feed, even though his last meals were from a can poured into a feeding tube. But even that can of Ensure was now a meal, perhaps for an entire day, for someone else. Tyler was dead, and there was a war, though it did not in any sense seem like a war that any had even conceptualized this way. And he was dead as surely as millions of others were now dead or dying after but 10 days. As dead as someone lying in the surf of Omaha Beach, the death camp of Auschwitz. As dead as any casualty of war. Frightened for a moment, John looked back at Jennifer, who stood in the doorway clutching her grandmother's side. The last of the ice had given out 2 days ago, the bottles of insulin now immersed in the tank of the basement toilet to keep them cool. And there was a flood of panic in John. He knew almost to the day how much insulin was left. He caught Jen's gaze. The way he was staring at her granddaughter, she pulled Jennifer in tighter to her side. He turned back to look at Tyler. "I think we should pray," John said. He went down on his knees and made the sign of the cross. "Hail Mary, full of grace." It was close to sunset. To the north, the hills, so affectionately known to all locals as the Seven Sisters, were bathed in the slanting golden light of evening. Beyond them was the massive bulk of Mount Mitchell, its slopes green as spring moved steadily upwards towards the summit. "I think that's deep enough, Ben," John said. Ben looked up from the grave he had been digging for the last 3 hours, helped by John's students, Phil and Jeremiah. Charlie had been right. The golf course was the ideal spot for the new cemetery, the earth easy to dig. Over 20 other graves had been dug this day, or were being dug now. The 7 who had died in the elementary school during the night, 5 others who had died during the day, and 3 suicides, though one minister had tried to protest that decision that they be buried in what was now consecrated ground. That protest was greeted with icy rejection from Charlie, who was now a former member of that congregation. There had also been 2 more heart attacks, 4 more elderly from the nursing home, and perhaps most tragic of all, the Morrison family, burying their 7-year-old boy, who had had an asthma attack. John tried to block out the screams of the mother as the dirt was shoveled into her boy's grave. Reverend Black drew away from the Morrisons and came over. "Ready, John?" John nodded. Richard Black looked exhausted, eyes bloodshot. The Morrison boy had been part of his congregation, a playmate of his son's. John looked over at Jeremiah and Phil and nodded. The 2 boys went to the car, opened the back seat, and struggled to pull Tyler's body out, wrapped in a quilt. He was already stiff with rigor mortis. They carried him over and stopped by the side of the grave, looking down, and John realized no one had thought about how to put the body into the grave. Always bodies had been in coffins. Concealed mechanical winches lowering them in a dignified manner. Jennifer broke away from her grandmother's side, hysterical, and ran away. John looked at Elizabeth, and she turned to chase after her sister. "I'll help," Rich said. He eased himself down into the grave, Ben joining him. They took the body from Phil and Jeremiah and maneuvered it down, then pulled themselves out. John found himself suddenly wondering why the old tradition of a grave supposedly having to be 6 foot deep existed. Fortunately, this one was maybe 3.5, 4 feet down and easier for the Reverend to get out of. Tyler rested in the bottom, face covered but bare feet exposed. and it struck John as obscene for him to be exposed thus. But there was nothing to be done for it now. John looked at Jen, who stood at the head of the grave, almost serenely detached. "I don't know the Catholic rite," Rich said. "I'm sorry."
"I don't think God or Tyler minds," Jen said. "You've been a friend and neighbor for years. I think he'd want you to do this for him, for us."
Rich opened his prayer book and started the traditional Presbyterian service for the dead. Finished at last, he went to Jen, hugged her and kissed her on the forehead, then did something John had seen only once before, at a Jewish funeral, years before. Rich picked up the shovel from the pile of earth, scooped up some dirt, and let it fall into the grave. The time John had seen that, it had shocked him. The funeral of the wife of a beloved grad school professor. The rabbi had thrown a shovelful in, then the husband, then family and friends had done so also, filling the grave in while John's beloved professor stood silent, watching the coffin disappear and the earth finally being mounded over. It was such a sharp, hard lesson about mortality, the returning of dust to dust, when compared to the American way of concealing death in euphemisms, with green astroturf to hide the raw earth, and the backhoe carefully hidden until the last of the mourners had left. That set Jen off, and at last she collapsed into tears. Rich looked at John and handed him the shovel. Though it was agony, both physical and emotional, he knew he had to do it. He filled the shovel, turned, hesitated, then let the dirt fall, covering Tyler's face. Lightheaded, John stepped back.
"We'll take care of it, sir."
It was Jeremiah. John nodded and handed the shovel over. He walked away, heading towards the park. Jennifer and her sister were in the playground, Jennifer sitting on a swing, her big sister sitting on the ground by her side. Jennifer looked up at his approach. Elizabeth stood up, tears streaming down her face, and came up to his side.
"Is it over?"
"Yes."
"I thought I should stay with her, Dad."
"You did the right thing."
"You've got to talk with her."
And Elizabeth's voice broke.
"She's thinking about..."
Her voice trailed off. "Go take care of your grandmother."
"Sure, Dad."
He went up to the swing and looked down at Jennifer. "You okay, sweetie?" She didn't speak, head lowered. She had brought Rabs along and was clutching him tight. John fumbled, fighting the fever, not sure what to say, afraid of what might be said. "Remember when I used to push you on the swing?" he said, filled now with nostalgia for that time when Mary was still alive, and they'd bring the girls down here to play, to feed the ducks, and, while Mary still had the strength, to walk around the lake. He got behind Jennifer, reached down with one hand to pull the swing back. "How about we do it again? I'll push to get you started." And with that, she was off the swing, crushing herself against his side, sobbing,
"Daddy, when will I be buried here?"
He knelt down and she wrapped her arms around his neck.
"Daddy, don't bury me here. I'd be afraid during the night. I always want to stay close to you. Please don't bury me here."
He dissolved into tears, hugging her tight. "I promise, sweetheart. You have years and years ahead. Daddy will always protect you." She drew back slightly and looked at him with solemn eyes, eyes filled with the wisdom of a child.
"I don't think so, Daddy."
That was all she said. Later he would remember that they remained like that for what seemed an eternity, and then gentle hands separated them, Jen's hands, and strong hands. Ben, John's two students, helped him back to the car. And then the fever drowned out all else. Chapter 7 Day 18 He awoke, feeling so weak he could barely lift his head.
So, the good professor is back from the dead.
He turned his head, focused. It was Michaela. She put the back of her hand to his forehead, a finger to his throat, and held it there for several seconds.
Fever's broke. Figured that during the night. Good pulse, too.
She smiled.
Well, John Matheson, I think you're going to pull through just fine now.
What happened?
Oh, you had it bad, real bad. Doc Keller was right, staph infection. I thought there was a chance that was your problem, but hoped it was something simpler and the Cipro would knock it out. Thought we'd lose you there for a couple of days, or at the very least your hand.
Panicked, he looked down. His hand was still there, shriveled, sore, but still there.
Twice its normal size 3 days back, started to look like septicemia and gangrene. But we kept hand and soul attached. Charlie Fuller approved some rather rare antibiotics for you. Just a few doses left now in our reserves, and Doc Keller was up here pumping them into you.
All that from a cut?
I told you to wash it out thoroughly and keep it bandaged,
she said chastisingly.
I regret now not coming up here that first night and doing it personally, but you might have seen that as too forward of me.
Wish you had. Forward or not.
She smiled and with a damp cloth wiped his brow.
I'm hungry.
I'll get you some soup.
Bathroom?
I'll get a bedpan.
Like hell, he whispered.
Don't be embarrassed, for God's sake. I've been your nurse for the last week.
Help me up.
Okay, then, but if you feel lightheaded, get back down.
She helped him to his feet. He did feel lightheaded, but said nothing. In fact, he felt like shit, mouth pasty, an atrocious taste. He brushed his good hand against his face, rough stubble actually turning into a beard, and just had a general feeling of being gritty and disgusting. He pushed her aside at the bathroom door and went in, used the toilet, fortunately someone had filled up the tank, and looked longingly at the bathtub. He so wanted a bath, to wash off.
Later, we'll have to boil up some water. I'll be damned if I take a cold bath.
He brushed his teeth. The tube of toothpaste was nearly empty, and beside it was a glass filled with ground-up wood charcoal. He used the toothpaste anyhow. That alone made a world of difference, and came back out. There was a smell, food, and he felt ravenous, and slowly walked back into the living room. Michaela was out on the porch stirring a pot. The old grill was pushed to one side. It must have finally run out of propane. Someone, most likely Ben or a couple of John's students, had rigged up something of an outdoor stove out of an old wood stove. Its legs jacked up with cinder blocks underneath so the cook didn't have to bend over. Michaela looked at him and smiled.
Hot dog soup with some potatoes mixed in. I'd suggest a Merlot, but the wine steward has the day off.
John smiled and sat down at the patio table.
Where are the girls?
Jen took them out for a walk with the dogs.
Michaela set the bowl down. Sure enough, it was hot dogs, cut up into bite-sized pieces mixed in with potatoes. He dug in, the first few spoonfuls scalding hot.
Take it slow.
She laughed, sitting down across from him, pushing the meat around with her spoon before taking a taste. She grimaced slightly.
I'm definitely not a cook.
It's great.
It's just because you're hungry. What I wouldn't give for shrimp. Chilled jumbo shrimp. A salad. A nice glass of Chardonnay.
He looked up at her.
If you hadn't saved my life, I think I'd tell you to shut up, he said with a bit of a grin.
She smiled back, and he could not help but notice how her T-shirt, sweat-soaked, clung to her body. His gaze lingered on her for several seconds until she made eye contact with him again.
My, you are getting healthy again,
she said softly, still smiling, and he lowered his eyes. The potatoes were good, though still a bit undercooked. He scraped down to the bottom of the bowl, picked it up to sip the last of the greasy fluid, and set it back down.
More?
She asked. He nodded.
Just take it slow. You had a rough siege of it there. Staph infections like that, well,
You are one tough guy to be up on your feet.
She stood and refilled his bowl. The girls, how are they?
Jen, she's a remarkable woman, tough as nails.
Of course she misses Tyler terribly. I could hear her crying at night. But at the same time is able to accept it, and then focus on those she loves that she feels responsible for.
Actually, I think she was a bit upset that I moved in here for several days to see after you. Said she could handle it herself.
You moved in?
Only temporary, John,
she replied with a smile as she put the bowl down in front of him and sat to resume her meal.
Doctor's orders, actually. Keller and Charlie were damn worried about you, said they wanted you alive and back on your feet. So I sort of got volunteered.
Reluctantly? John asked. She smiled.
Not exactly.
I really don't remember that much.
Well, you damn near had your brain fried. Temp up at 105, hands swollen like a balloon. 3 weeks back and you'd have been in isolation in an ICU, ice-packed, IVs. It got a bit rough there. Keller thought he'd have to go to amputation to save you if the antibiotics didn't get the infection under control.
Just from a cut in a stupid fight.
I warned you, she said, half waving her spoon at him. Staff in a hospital is a 24/7 fight. That nursing home, 3 days without cleaning, sanitation, you had 100 different microbes floating around there, and you just so happened to pick one of the worst.
How?
How? You had an open wound damn near to the bone. Touching a counter, a patient... Remember, John, the old days are gone. Hospitals are more dangerous now than just staying at home.
How is it up there?
12 left of the original patients.
What? There used to be over 60.
31 dead. 6 just disappeared.
What do you mean, disappeared?
Alzheimer's that were still mobile. Remember, no security alarms. They just wandered outside into the woods. Poor souls. Most likely died within a day or two from exposure. We decided yesterday to abandon the place, move those who are left up to a dorm in the conference center. Without all the electronics, you can't keep an eye on the Alzheimer's. I never thought I'd see such a thing again, but we have them restrained, tied to their beds, she sighed. Sounds horrible, John, but it will be best when they're gone. We need at least 4 people staffing them around the clock. At least at the dorm there's only 2 doors in and out, and frankly, it's cleaner.
What else? She sighed.
It's been bad.
How so?
A fight at the Gap 2 nights ago.
How bad?
More than 200 dead on both sides. Several hundred injured.
Jesus, what happened?
Well... We were letting folks through 100 at a time. Again, your suggestion, good professor. It was going slow, though, and now the refugees from Winston-Salem, Charlotte, Greensboro, even some from as far as Durham, were piling up on that road. God, John, it's positively medieval down on that road. Squatters' camps, people fighting for a scrap of food. Disease breaking out, mostly salmonella, pneumonia, a nasty variant of the flu... Well, a group was being escorted through, and they broke, started running to get off the interstate and into the woods. 2 of them had concealed pistols, shot the 2 policemen escorting them, shot them dead on the spot, and then they just started scattering. Tom ordered them rounded up. Doc Keller was having a fit as well that they might be carrying something. It turned ugly. Most were too weak to get far, but some of them did put up a fight. About 20 are unaccounted for. Disappeared up into the hills. Most are harmless, but a few, the ringleaders, they're out there. And Tom is hunting them down. That triggered the riot back at the barrier. Charlie ordered it shut down until the mess was straightened out, and they just rioted. I mean, thousands of them just pushing against the barrier of cars and trucks. Tom did have some tear gas to push them back, but then they came back in.
So we opened fire. She nodded.
You could hear it all over town. Sounded like a regular war. Tom had a couple of men with automatic weapons posted up on the side of the pass, firing down. John, I never dreamed we'd be doing this to each other.
She fell silent, poking at a piece of hot dog at the bottom of her bowl. He looked at her, realizing how random fate had played out in her life. If she had not come to Asheville for a meeting that day, she'd have been in Charlotte when everything shut down. Maybe she'd be secure, given her job at a hospital. Then again, she could have been one of the refugees storming the barrier, desperate for a piece of bread, half a bowl of the soup he and she were now eating.
"I could have been on the other side," she said quietly.
She looked up at him, and for a moment there was rage in her eyes, as if they actually were from opposing camps, two enemies sharing a meal under a temporary truce before the killing started again. "You weren't, though. You're here, and you're safe."
"For how long, John? Some might say I'm still an outsider."
"Damn it, Michaela, don't say that word again."
"Well, you should have heard some of the people talking after that fight. 27 locals were killed in it, a couple of them police officers, and there were more than one standing around the town offices yesterday talking about kicking out anyone who didn't belong."
"That's bullshit. Scared talk by scared people."
"Amazing, isn't it?" she said, shaking her head.
"3 weeks ago, we were all Americans. Hell, if somebody said an offensive word, made a racial or sexist slur, my God, everyone would be up in arms and it'd be front-page news.
Turn off the electricity and bang, we're at each other's throats in a matter of days. Outsiders, locals. Is the whole country now like this, 10,000 little fiefdoms ready to kill each other, and everyone on the road part of some barbarian horde on the march?"
He couldn't reply. He feared that it just might be true, but still he couldn't believe it, in spite of what had just happened. "We're still Americans," he sighed. "I need to believe that. We've turned on each other in the past. Remember, we once fought a war against ourselves, with 600,000 dead. As a kid, I remember the riots in Newark, the hatred that created between us, how that still lingered years afterwards. And yet when it really counted, we did band together as one.
But now?
People are hungry, scared. We were spoiled, unlike any generation in history, and we forgot completely just how dependent we were on the juice flowing through the wires, the buttons doing something when we pushed them. If only we had some communication, if only we knew the government still worked, a voice that we trusted being heard, that would make all the difference. My grandfather used to tell me how back during the Depression the banks started to collapse. There was panic, even a scent of revolution in the air. And then FDR got on the radio, just one radio talk, reminding us we were all neighbors, to cooperate and help each other. And though the Depression went on for 7 more years, the panic ended. Same thing on 9/11. I think it's the silence that is driving people crazy now. No one knows what is going on, what is being done, if we are indeed at war, and if so, who we are fighting, and whether we are winning or losing. We are as isolated now as someone in Europe 700 years ago, and there is a rumor, just a rumor, that the Tartars are coming, or there is a plague in the next village. He sighed, motioning for another bowl. She refilled his and hers. In the past, any disaster, it was always local, or regional at worst, the hurricanes in 2004. It slammed us pretty hard here. Most of the news focused on Florida, but I tell you, we got some of the worst of it right here, with two of those hurricanes literally crisscrossing over the top of us only days apart. But all along, we knew help was out there. The guys who hooked my electric back up after 4 days were a crew from Birmingham, Alabama. The truck that brought in thousands of gallon jugs of water came from Charlotte, actually, and always there were still battery-powered radios. If only we could get a link back up. I think that would calm a lot of nerves. Has there been any contact at all from the outside? She sipped a spoonful of soup, then shook her head.
Not a word. A helicopter flew over 2 days ago. You should have seen people. It was like some god was passing by in a floating chariot, everyone with hands raised up, shouting. No, not a word, other than rumors from those passing through. Global war, Chinese invading, help coming from Europe, plague in Washington, a military coup. A lot of talk now about some religious crazies forming into gangs, claiming it's the apocalypse and either join them or die. It's all crazy, and they know about as much as you or me.
It's the cars as well, John said. They are such an ingrained part of our lives, right down to the fact that there are suburbs and people commute into cities. Hell, 100 years ago, this house never would have been built, no matter how great the view. Too far from downtown, even if the town is just a small village. This isn't farmland. It's actually useless land, other than for timber. But the auto made this valuable. Look at how people are migrating even now. By instinct, they're following the interstate highways.
Turn off all the cars. I think that is what scared us the most. The damn things were not just about transportation. They were definers of social status, wealth, age, class. You, for instance.
Me?
Beamer, 330. Told me right off you didn't have kids. If you were married, you and your husband were definitely upwardly mobile types, professionals. She laughed softly.
Post-divorce crisis car.
He nodded. I really know nothing about you, Michaela.
Just that. Post-divorce car. My husband and I met as undergrads at Duke, both pre-med.
John laughed. Mary and I were at Duke as well, though I guess around 10-15 years ahead of you. I was history. She was biology. We both wanted to teach. I got into the Army through ROTC when they offered me a darn good deal.
Saw that. Your diploma's in your office. Rather impressive, John. Master's from Purdue, Ph.D. from UVA in history. I thought you were Army.
Hey, the Army educates, and they were crazy enough to pay for it and send me. For every hour I carried a gun, I spent 100 in a classroom or archive. Did have a few field commands. First with a recon company with the 1st Cav in Germany, just before communism gave up the ghost. Actually enjoyed that posting. Gave me a lot of time to explore history over there besides my duties. Then Desert Storm. My battalion mobilized over and I was looking forward to the challenge of command in a line company when I got promoted to major, then kicked up the ladder to Battalion XO. It took me out of the front line, and I always wondered since if I had somehow missed something as a result. But enough on me, she smiled.
Well, we got married right after he graduated 2 years ahead of me, and the classic old routine, Michaela said with a sigh. I switched majors to nursing to start the money rolling. Agreement was, once he got into residency, I'd go back for pre-med.
And let me guess, John interjected. He got his M.D. and you got the divorce as a thank you.
Something like that. Just grew apart, I guess.
Another woman wandered in. Actually, several women, and I got fed up and left.
Young doctors with big egos, starry-eyed nurses saying, "Oh, doctor, it's 2 in the morning. Happens all the time."
He looked at her. The slight show of dimples when she smiled, clear blue eyes, tall, slender figure, and shook his head.
He was an idiot.
"John, you hardly know me," she smiled. "So don't just judge by exteriors. I have my bad side, too."
"Well, I've yet to see it. Volunteering to go up and help at the nursing home, that took guts."
"Or it could have been calculation," she replied. "Get into the community that way."
He looked straight at her, remembering what she said on the day he had shot Larry, and shook his head.
"No. You'd have done it regardless of the situation."
He hesitated, looking back down at the soup bowl.
"And any guys for you?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Just trying to put the pieces together."
"No one serious, if that's what you mean. Gun shy."
"And no kids?"
Thank God, no.
Why?
Now, with this, you think I'd want that worry on top of everything else? Suppose we did have children, and I was up here the day it happened. I'd have been clawing through the tide of refugees to get back to Charlotte.
He nodded.
The way she said clawing through told him a lot. She liked kids, maybe wished she had some, and had the instinct to kill to protect them, no matter whose they were.
"Let's talk about Jennifer," she said quietly.
"Is there a problem?" he asked, suddenly anxious.
"Of course there is, John. You got enough insulin for a little more than 4 months, though the water temperature where you are storing the vials is just over 50 degrees. I checked it. That will degrade the shelf life somewhat."
"By how much?" he asked, feeling a sense of panic.
"I'm not sure, John. We'll start to know when the regular dose doesn't control her blood sugar. Besides that, we have to start getting conservative with her testing kit. The new one, as you know, is junked. The old one, thank God, survived. But the test strips, no replacements now. So we're going to have to learn to just eyeball the situation more and only use the strips when we absolutely have to." He couldn't speak, just staring off across the valley. It was all so peaceful. No noise, some plumes from small fires rising up, drifting with the westerly breeze. He reached to his breast pocket. No pocket. He was still in a sweat-soaked T-shirt.
"Cigarette?" she asked.
He nodded.
"I'll get them."
She came back out a minute later with two, struck a lighter and puffed one to life, hesitated for a second, then handed it to John, putting the second one on the table.
"Ex-smoker?"
John asked.
"Yep.
Surprising how many nurses smoke. But I looked at one too many cancerous lungs, though."
"Don't need to hear it." She smiled.
"Well, you're going to run out in about 2 weeks anyhow. Stretch it, and you might make it to 4 weeks or 6, but sooner or later you will quit. Maybe one of the few blessings to come out of this. An entire nation going cold turkey on tobacco, alcohol, drugs. No cars, so we have to walk or ride bikes. Might do us some good."
"Back to Jennifer," he said, after taking several puffs. The meal was sitting well on his stomach, but the tobacco hit him after so many days away. He felt shaky and suddenly weak.
"Tyler's death, the funeral," she said. "If I had been around and knew, I'd have kept Jennifer home during the burial. It really traumatized her. It's tough enough on any kid of that age to lose their grandpa, but we, all of us, have really isolated death away, kept it hidden. Tyler died in her bedroom. In fact, she is terrified to even go back in there. When she'd come to see you when you were sick, she'd just stand by the doorway. It's just that she saw it all, and it registered. John, she's a diabetic, and even at 12 that makes anyone very conscious of their mortality. They know their life is dependent on that needle and the vial, but for 70 years now, those vials just came across the pharmacy counter, no questions asked. She knows that's finished."
"How?"
"Damn it, John, she isn't deaf or blind. Every day since this started, people have been dying, and she knows she's on the short list once the insulin in the basement runs out."
He shook his head angrily. "No, God, please, no. That's 4 months off. By then we'll have something back in place, at least communications, some emergency medicines."
"John, you've been the very person going around saying that this is bad, real bad, that it might take years, if ever, to come back from it."
"I never said a word around her."
"Oh, John, you're such a father, but you don't understand kids. I've worked in hospitals with kids like Jennifer, kids that were terminal. They had it figured out long before their parents would ever admit it to themselves."
"She is not terminal," he snarled, glaring at Michaela angrily.
She said nothing.
"Damn you! No!"
And he was humiliated by the tears that suddenly clouded his vision. He struggled to choke back the sobs that now overwhelmed him. She put her hand out, touching him, and he jerked back, looking at her, filled with impotent rage.
"My girl will live through this," he gasped. "Jennifer will live through this."
She leaned over, gently touching his face, paused, and then half stood up, kissing him on the forehead, and drew her chair closer to his side. "John, with luck, if things straighten out, we'll get hooked back up to hospitals that work before the insulin runs out." He noticed how she said "we." "I've gotten close to her, John. Very close, these last few days. She's a sweet child. Not a 12-year-old dressing, talking, and sometimes acting like she's 21. She still sleeps with Rabs in her arms, plays with Beanie Babies, reads a lot. The way perhaps 12-year-olds were long ago. Rather nerdy, actually." He struggled for control as Michaela described his little girl. He let the burned-out cigarette fall, and without comment she lit the second one and handed it over, taking a puff on it first before doing so. She smiled, and he realized that tears were in her eyes as well. "It's just the poor child has really been obsessive about dying since she saw her grandfather go and the way he was buried, the way we're burying people now by the hundreds."
"I'll talk with her."
"I already have," Michaela said quietly.
"About what?" She hesitated. "Go on. About what?"
"About death," she whispered. "She asked me for the truth. About how long she had if the insulin ran out."
"And what did you tell her?" he snapped.
And she grimaced as he grasped her arm with his hand.
"What did you tell her?"
"John, I told you I've worked with kids like her. I know when to lie. I know when it is time to tell the truth. I reassured her that she'd be okay, that you and others were working to get things reestablished, and soon medical supplies would start coming in." He released his grip.
"Sorry," he whispered.
"But you've got to talk with her too, John."
He nodded, head lowered, again struggling for control.
He felt so damn weak, not just physically, but emotionally. Tyler's time had played out, and though John had come to love that old man as if he were John's own father, he took solace knowing Tyler had lived a good life. But Jennifer... "You better keep reassuring her if you want her to be happy," Michaela paused.
"In the time she has left?" he asked, staring at her.
"Let's just pray for the best."
He finished his cigarette and sat back. "You said hundreds have been buried?" She nodded and then looked away. He heard barking and then laughter. From out of the field above the house, his family was coming. The dogs, seeing him up and about again, made a beeline straight to him. He could not help but laugh, both dogs grinning at him and dancing around his chair. And then, with noses raised, they were sniffing at the soup pot. Ginger standing up on her hind legs to peer in, nearly burning her feet as she lost balance and almost fell against the stove. Jennifer came running down and jumped into his arms.
"You're better, Daddy."
"Well, not exactly, but almost, Pumpkin."
She buried her head against his shoulder, and he wondered for a moment if she was crying. And then she pulled back slightly.
"Daddy, you really stink."
He laughed, tempted to play the old armpit game of grabbing her and forcing her up against his armpit. She loved it when she was 8, even as she shrieked in protest. But not now. He knew he really did stink.
"I promise I'll take a bath later today. I could use it."
"Outdoors now, Daddy,"
she said, pointing to a small kiddie wading pool and a rough-built shower made out of a 6-foot ladder with a 1-gallon plastic bucket suspended from the top rung by a 2x4, the bottom of the bucket perforated with a couple of dozen small holes.
"Ben built it. One person showers, the other pours the water into the bucket while standing on the ladder."
Ben made that, and John nodded. and then, suddenly wondered, Michaela laughed.
I do the pouring for Elizabeth, John.
Well, Ben can pour for me, and you ladies can go somewhere else. Jennifer hugged him tight, let go, and looked into the pot.
What is it?
Hot dogs and potatoes, Michaela announced.
Yuck, sounds gross.
Really, it's